SNI Innovations in Learning, in association with the UCLA Department of Neurosurgery, Linda Liao, the chairwoman, and its faculty are pleased to bring you the UCLA Department of Neurosurgery 101 Lecture Series on Neurosurgery and Clinical and Basic Neuroscience. This series of lectures are provided free to bring the advances in clinical and basic neuroscience to physicians and patients everywhere. One out of every five people in the world suffer from a neurologically related disease. This will be a lecture and discussion on a 2024 review on the status of meningioma, the diagnosis, treatment, molecular and genetic data, and clinical courses. It will be given by Richard G. Everson, who's in the Department of Neurosurgery at the UCLA Medical Center in Los Angeles, California.
So meningiomas have been described as the soul of neurosurgery. In the preface to Al Mefty's sort of seminal book on meningiomas, he says the progress in meningioma treatment has mirrored the advances in neurosurgery. Advancements in neurosurgery are put to maximal use to improve the treatment of meningiomas, and things like the development of the operating microscope, ultrasonic aspiration, neuromonitoring, all those things are clear evidence of that. And I think it definitely holds true today as we advance even beyond sometimes what we think of as in the operating room to our molecular understanding of the pathogenesis of meningiomas as well. This sort of exciting evolution was kind of cool to see when going back to the start, when I had the occasion to visit the Cushing Museum, which is at Yale University, and houses a collection of brains of Cushing's patients, and as well as their tumors, and you could kind of see where it all got started. And so seeing the continuum is really a pretty exciting thing. Cushing had some interesting and somewhat disparate thoughts about meningioma surgery, at least they come through in his writing. You know, in one place in a lecture that he gave, he described meningioma as, typical convexity meningioma that's amenable to surgery as, the surgeon's friend, and said there is today nothing in the whole realm of surgery more gratifying than a successful removal of a meningioma, subsequent perfect functional recovery, especially should a correct pathologic diagnosis have been made. At the same time, in the preface to his book, he talks about the neurosurgeon who treats patients with meningiomas must have more than an amateur's knowledge. It's fair to say that few procedures in surgery may be more immediately formidable than the attack upon a large tumor of the type herein discussed, and that the ultimate prognosis hinges more on the surgeon's experience with the problem and all its many aspects than is true of almost any other operation that can be named. So he kind of has this warning at the same time. Turns out today we sort of face the same problem in that, we would like to know everything that we could about a meningioma, but oftentimes we're faced with big gaps in knowledge of what really makes up the tumor, what's driving it, how it will behave, and whether or not we're making the right treatment recommendations all of the time. So there are some things we do know. History has given us a lot of information about meningiomas. This term itself was coined in 1922 by Cushing, describing a slow-growing extra-axial tumor. This meningioma stuck a little bit better than meningothelioma, I guess easier to say. Eisenhart postulated the origin from arachnoid cap cells, which derive from neural crest. These are concentrated in major walls of venous sinuses, where there are arachnoid granulations, and this accounts for the most common location of these tumors. 1900s, Virchow described the somoma body, which is a common feature of meningiomas. Subsequently, investigations into them have sort of converged to an idea that they might actually be a process to slow the growth of the tumor. And then beyond that, we've learned that most meningiomas by far are benign, and we describe these as WHO grade 1. A few are atypical and have a higher propensity for recurrence, and even slimmer numbers are anaplastic and really have malignant potential. In the 1950s, Simpson correlated the surgical resection and the extent of resection of meningiomas with the rates of symptomatic recurrence. And we've also come to know that metastases are uncommon, but may be seen, you know, across the spectrum of meningiomas. Lots of statistical data we've accumulated from things like the Central Brain Tumor Registry of the United States. We know that meningioma is the most common central nervous system tumor. They are mostly considered benign and are often asymptomatic and diagnosed incidentally. Standard studies based on histopathology probably underestimate their true incidence by several fold. In a study of 2,000 asymptomatic volunteer subjects who underwent 1.5 Tesla MRI, meningiomas, completely incidental, were found in about 1% of them. They range from 5 millimeters to 60 millimeters in diameter, and their prevalence was a little bit higher in women and in elderly. Beyond that, autopsy studies show that that's probably even still a big underestimate. In that people over 60, we can find them in 3% of the time. Most of them are less than a centimeter, but you know that could be up to half or more of all the meningiomas that are out there. The growth and survival of meningiomas, we understand from retrospective case studies. The diagnosis is often made solely on radiological means. We don't biopsy these up front to understand them. We know that the average growth pattern is about 2 millimeters a year, but the range on that is an unfortunate zero to basically exponential or infinity. And so it's not particularly helpful in figuring out what's going to happen with one. We know that 10-year overall survival rates for grade one meningiomas are around 80 plus percent. It's about 50% lower for grade two, and grade threes, which are highly malignant, really have a very poor prognosis with very few long-term survival. Progression of the disease is really, it's got varying definitions, but we're talking about either growth, residual tumor, transformation to higher grade.
Where does that come from? Because that doesn't match up with any type of clinical experience. For grade ones, it's about 1 millimeter a year. Grade twos, it goes into the 2 to 4, but where did that average growth rate come from? Because I follow a lot of meningiomas. Rarely do they ever grow at this rate. So how could this be the average growth rate?
We probably got some of these numbers from earlier imaging eras where there wasn't the ubiquity of MRI like it is today.
I think it's about 1 millimeter a year for grade one. This value just doesn't sound reasonable to me.
Sure. The National Comprehensive Cancer Network has some guidelines on how to treat meningiomas. These are pretty exceedingly vague. They basically recommend if you think you've got a meningioma, you could either observe it, do surgery, or do radiotherapy on it. They recommend, favoring observation for smaller asymptomatic tumors and favoring surgery and postoperative radiotherapy, really depending on what the pathology shows. Beyond that, even in the setting of recurrence, it's basically anything is an option. Surgery, if accessible, radiation, if possible, if not possible, systemic therapy, or continued observation if you can do it. The variability in this behavior of meningiomas really creates a big problem for the potential for undertreatment versus overtreatment. The patients who get surprised with a higher grade meningioma obviously do poorly, and the survival curves show that steep drop off in the beginning there, which would be folks who were clearly undertreating. But then we know that probabilistically speaking, and based on the differential grades, there's probably a whole lot of people who don't really need any treatment. So we've got, sort of a double-edged sword here. So we need better tools to make better predictions. And that's been the focus of a lot of research. Coming from it thinking about it oncologically. You know, are there risk factors? Are there preventative measures that can be taken? A whole bunch of different things have been examined very closely. A few things have found substantial links, and some other things have been disproven. Some of the stronger linked things are certainly exposure to ionizing radiation to the skull. You know, this is going to increase the risk 6 to 10 fold. This has seen borne out in atomic bomb survivors with, you know, a correlation between the distance to epicenter. It's also seen in people who received low-dose scalp radiation for things like ringworm, dental x-rays, and then people, especially survivors of childhood cancers, which had cranial radiation years out. Other things that have been studied extensively, exposure to estrogen and progesterones. You know, this was highlighted because of the increased incidence in women. Multiple studies have been conducted, but there's no, it hasn't been definitive links. There's a lot of sort of theories and even mechanistic explanations of why hormones could affect meningioma growth, and including links to progesterone receptor signaling and increasing signaling through NF2 gene, which we'll talk about a little bit later, which is really a central driver of meningiomas. But the epidemiologic studies really haven't come to a conclusion, at least in favor of standard estrogen or progesterones. There are some progesterone-only birth control formulations that are popular in Europe that have been linked to it. But beyond that, most do not have a solid link. Same thing holds true for traumatic brain injury. Large-scale study in Denmark with, you know, 200,000 people basically didn't show any evidence of increased rates of meningioma. Same thing for smoking, diabetes, asthma, and eczema, which was of interest because of its link to glial tumors, mobile phone use, et cetera. Nothing conclusive. The only other thing besides radiation that's been linked are familial genetic syndromes like neurofibromatosis type 2, Lee from any Gorlin, Cowden, VHL, or multiple endocrine neoplasia syndrome. We'll talk a little bit more about NF2, as I mentioned. Radiologic features on CT scan. You can see intratumoral calcifications or hyperostosis, remodeling of the bone. On CT scan, the meningioma tumor itself is hyperdense or isodense. Necrosis would be evident on a CT, but again, that's uncommon. You know, only about 15 to 20% will demonstrate calcification. Same thing with hyperostosis. Hyperostosis can be extreme, can be minimal, and it's not proportional to tumor grade or predictive of grade. It's also, you know, a bit controversial whether or not hyperostosis really represents tumor invasion or not. It's actually not that well borne out, but it's likely that there's probably forms of both a reactive hyperostosis and really a tumor infiltration that can account for the same kind of imaging findings. MRI obviously is a gold standard for meningioma. You're going to find a homogeneously enhancing circumscribed dural base lesion with a dural tail. You know, it's not the only thing that could have a dural tail. There's other disease types like metastases, lymphoma, solitary fibrous tumors, gliosarcomas, non-tumor conditions like sarcoid or granuloma disease could also have a dural tail. But, you know, the constellation of the findings really is what leads you to the diagnosis. You can also see a CSF cleft sign typically in lower grade tumors, edema, often in higher grade tumors, but it can also be present in particular subtypes of low grade tumors like secretory meningiomas. Again, we mentioned necrosis before, that can portend a higher grade. Sort of adjunct MR techniques like spectroscopy and perfusion are also helpful. More so in the post-treatment setting of delineating things like radiation necrosis from tumor progression. On that front, PET is certainly something being explored in meningiomas. You know, the standard FDG PET has also been used for what I just mentioned in terms of delineating radiation necrosis versus progression. But it also turns out that since meningiomas highly express somatostatin receptors, you can actually delineate their extent, especially in difficult to visualize anatomic regions, with PET analogs like 68 gallium dotatate or dotatoc. This is increasingly being used in centers where it's available to delineate targets, especially for radiotherapy, like in a lesion that I've got here, where it's a little bit hard to tell where the tumor ends and say the normal pituitary gland begins. Treatment-wise, you know, as I mentioned, a big majority of these things are asymptomatic, incidentally found. So observation is a pretty reasonable thing to do. You're generally going to favor that for patients with small or asymptomatic lesions, like I said. Some studies looking at this, trying to catalog their experience, you know, this Bebahani 5-year prospective study to look at risk factors that could describe what type of tumor is likely to grow. You know, in their particular study that they published, actually none of the patients that they were following of 65 developed tumor-related symptoms during the 5-year follow-up. And this was often despite, you know, a majority of them demonstrating, you know, growth increases by 15% or more. They did find that a majority of those that did grow, they didn't necessarily continue to grow, but sometimes reach a plateau and self-limited before developing symptoms. On the contrary, another series doing a similar kind of thing demonstrated about a quarter of them with significant or rapid growth. Factors that correlated with that were things like tumor size, especially those above 40 millimeters, absence of calcification, peritumoral edema, hyperintensity or isointensity on T2. So these are basically, you know, kind of, it's a little bit of the flip side of calcification, but it has some intrinsic properties too. And they took these variables and basically created a calculator, you know, risk calculator app that you can apply to your patients at, you know, from this impactmeningioma.com. And large scale validations of this model are underway. And so it'll be pretty interesting to see if that bears out. And certainly if it correlates with some of the other things that we'll get to a little bit later in the talk with molecular pathology and or grading. This calculator that they have also gives some recommendations on interval follow-up, how frequently it should be with basically patients following into the lowest risk lowest risk groups not really needing continued follow-up. But you know, beyond that, guidelines recommend annual follow-up for about 5 years after diagnosis. Surgery for meningioma certainly is the option or the preferred treatment for patients presenting with mass effect or related symptoms, things like seizures, weakness, focal neurologic deficits, cranial neuropathies. This is going to warrant a prompt evaluation and some kind of intervention, at least. Certainly, you know, location matters exquisitely with, you know, the size of a lesion when it becomes symptomatic. Things like near the optic canal or CP angle are going to require surgery at much smaller sizes. There's other features that I mentioned before, you know, that need to be, can be taken into account, peritumoral edema, bony invasion, but they, again, they don't perfectly correlate with grade, but they're often, you know, part of the equation. Translating what we do in meningiomas to principles of surgical oncology, you know, the goal in tumor surgery is to take, you know, as much tumor with as wide of a margin as possible, as long as one can safely do that. The traditional concepts derived from really sort of orthopedic oncology or in the extremity of things like performing a radical resection, which is the removal of the entire affected tissue compartment, are not really feasible when it comes to the central nervous system. This would be removing the entire dura. So really, probably what we're looking at or looking for is a wide margin, which is taking a margin of normal tissue surrounding a resection. This is the concept that was illustrated very well by Simpson in the 1950s with basically increasing extent of resection and wider margins around the tumor itself, correlated with decreased recurrence at 10 years. A grade one resection was macroscopic, complete resection of the tumor, excision of the dural attachment, abnormal bone, and when involved, venous sinuses. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. Grade two is the tumor with coagulation of the attachment. Grade three is just the tumor without any manipulation of the dural attachment. Grade four is debulking, and grade five is biopsy only. And you know, the recurrence rate increases sort of proportionately with those. However, recent studies, probably due to the effect of modern radiation therapy, show progression-free survival is not really statistically different between grades one, two, and three compared to each other compared to four and five. And this leads to the concept of what we would term a gross total resection of the tumor versus a subtotal resection. Even so, it's still sort of recommended or felt that it's worth recording an operative note, because your only time that you're going to be able to actually count and measure a Simpson grade resection is intraoperatively. You can't do this postoperatively. And that's sort of what I'm illustrating there with the figure of removal of this olfactory groove meningioma of, you can't tell what was done to the dura. Unfortunately, for surgery, we don't have randomized controlled trials to compare surgery to other therapies directly. This extent of resection data, like from Simpson and from other series, is all established by institutional case series. And as I mentioned, this concept has formulated that in modern clinical trials, most of the time we are defining extent of resection as either gross or subtotal. Again, because Simpson is really impossible to derive on large scale data sets, unless it's specifically recorded. So when you're correlating to gross total resection across grades, it still parallels what was seen in Simpson with, around 10 to 20% 5-year recurrences in grade one, 50% in grade two, and more like 75 in grade three. Other surgical guidelines support the use of intraoperative adjuncts like image guidance, intraoperative imaging like ultrasound to use for a concept of adaptive hybrid surgery, which would be, leaving a small volume residual for SRS. We'll kind of go a little bit deeper into that. Intraoperative neurophysiologic monitoring to minimize deficits, and the use of endoscopic techniques are certainly supported and found to be viable, but no study has demonstrated a clear superiority of endoscopic versus open cranial techniques, especially was evident in a meta-analysis comparing olfactory groove and tuberculum cell meningiomas operated via endoscopy or cranial. It's basically dealer's choice and up to the expertise of the surgeon. There are some fundamentals of meningioma surgery that I think apply to all cases. You have to maintain the concept that these are extra axial lesions. You need to remove bone, perform a craniotomy of sufficient size in order to define the tumor, or at least the approach corridor, in order to minimize injury to the surrounding neurovascular structures. The process of surgery then moves to devascularization of the tumor to minimize bleeding, debulking the core, and then dissecting the now malleable capsule from neurovascular structures. There's not a rule that all of this has to proceed in that order only. This certainly can be an iterative type of thing in order to mobilize and remove large tumors. We've, in our conferences, have certainly discussed the concept that meningioma is a surgery of veins. That's certainly true for many tumors, but with the variety of locations that these appear, I really think all interfaces with all types of anatomy or neurovascular concepts come into play. The one here on the right certainly would be one that you would, give consideration to the superior sagittal sinus, but it's also indenting into leg motor cortex of the brain. The one to the left of that CP angle meningioma entering the IAC, you're going to be mostly concerned about nerves. The one here that's engulfing the carotid bifurcation, you're worried more about arteries. This one here that developed central necrosis, well, you're really thinking more along the lines of oncologic considerations, because that necrosis certainly would be worrisome for development of grade three type tumors. Just a note, consider the adjacent brain if it's adherent. These are extraaxial tumors, but certainly, it's not a foreign concept to need to map the underlying brain to understand where things like primary motor or supplementary motor area are. And that's an easy enough thing to do in things like parasagittal meningiomas by phase reversal. Again, it comes down to a lot of what you see at surgery. Even some of the biggest, nastiest tumors on MRI can sort of fall right off the brain, like a rib falling off the bone of a nice slow cooked barbecue. But you often aren't going to know this until you get in there. So your plan has to take into account what you're going to do if it is adherent to potentially eloquent brain. Sagittal sinus involvement. Historically, there were a lot of advocates for complete resection and reconstruction of the sagittal sinus, certainly much more controversial now, especially with data that we have supporting really good long-term control of small residual with stereotactic radiosurgery. It was held pretty firmly that resecting the anterior third of the superior sagittal sinus is not likely to cause complications, but that doesn't really hold up in the face of retrospective case series that show non-zero mortality, even when it's described as completely occluded. Reasons that are posed for that is there are got to be collaterals draining the brain somewhere, or diplopic veins going through the skull that get destroyed with the craniotomy. A detailed understanding of the venous drainage pattern is certainly warranted for any such explorations. People have advocated testing the pressures in the brain with manometry, putting a needle in the sinus, clamping it somewhere and seeing if the pressure really rises. This is suggested in describing techniques, but there's not really any high level evidence to support it. Manipulation of the sinus, obviously thrombogenic, will require anticoagulants, also controversial. Opening the sinus with direct closure, again, high risk. With the success of SRS, especially for small volume residuals, it's hard to justify in the modern era. And then there's another concept, certainly, of stage resection, allowing the sinus to go down and incompletely occluded sinus to occlude and allow the development of collateralization, come back at a different time and resect it then when it's safer. Bridging veins are another concept entirely. Even some of the strongest advocates for resection of the sinus would say that the repair or attempted repair or reconstruction of a bridging vein is dangerous, and safety would not support doing that to remove or change your Simpson grade resection from a 4 likely to a 3. Similarly, embolization is a thing that's discussed a lot. There are some guidelines that actually recommend against embolization due to really a lack of high-level evidence supporting it. Post-op cardiovascular complications above a rate of about 5% will negate pretty much any demonstrated benefit, which is at this time basically only a reduction in surgery time and potentially of blood loss or need for transfusion, but even that's a little bit questionable. Most people would not argue with the concept, though, that for a deep seated tumor that's very difficult to access, like a petrochlival or tentorial meningioma, embolizing the deep branches that you will reach last in the operation could be helpful. There's still no guideline or data to back that up. Same thing for timing of intervention. Everyone has a different theory on it, and some people say you shouldn't embolize anywhere other than a hybrid OR suite, and other people might do it months before. But again, we just don't have the level of data to support a recommendation. Other things that we're advocating in the past that I think are a little bit more questionable now: CP angle, cavernous sinus surgery are very risky to cranial nerves. Most series, even in expert hands, you know, will demonstrate rates of, you know, 35% of cranial nerve deficits postoperatively in CP angle, especially with larger tumors. Cavernous sinus, even higher, 50 to 80%. And that's, you know, potentially permanent. So many authors now advocate debulking extra cavernous portion and using radiation on the rest. I would say that, you know, the time that you might consider a really aggressive surgery is if the situation has become what I would describe as sort of oncologic, where, you know, there's life-threatening situation and, you know, a planned morbid operation, you know, for life-saving measures might be necessary. Radiotherapy. Yeah.
Typically, investigation of embolization, of isolated embolization, is such a workable strategy.
There has. It long term, I don't think it really panned out. You know, there are, I think, as many reports of successful, you know, inducing the tumor to become necrotic and die off as there were of inducing hemorrhage, edema, herniation, seizure. So, you know, I'm not aware of a randomized controlled trial showing that or anything that has more solid things. There's just, you know, a lot of it is expert opinion.
Issue. I agree with you. It's rarely necessary. You can take the middle meningeal often surgically, but for patients who are cash pay, you'll see that, you know, the hospital will offer them if you come for your meningioma resection, you need to pay $60,000 cash. If you embolize it, it's $160,000 cash. It's $100,000 for that embolization. And we're going to be increasingly viewed by third-party payers and all that on how our value basis in terms of how we treat patients with value, how much does it cost to treat them. So as we keep on telling you, don't open the spes or bipolars and all that, there's a reason that it's all going to, this is going to impact your career. You have to do the right thing for the patient, but embolization is a waste of money and it's not safe in 5% of the cases. So
yeah, 5% is a good expert center, having had experience at centers with higher complication rates. I can tell you the balance is a little bit different. Radiotherapy, you know, the concept obviously is to decrease recurrence and improve local control. It's not necessarily, it's not advocated or useful in radically resected grade one meningiomas because that, you know, is associated with a pretty high rate of cure. SRS or 50 gray of external beam radiation is an option, and incomplete resection of grade one tumors. It's a good idea, like I mentioned, in cavernous sinus, or if, you know, a subsequent operation is not feasible to remove the rest of the tumor. Grade two meningiomas, the role of radiotherapy is very controversial still. It's a little more advocated in cases of incomplete resection. We'll go a little more in depth not in a second. Grade three, on the other hand, are so malignant that it is standard of care to give high dose 60 gray radiation post-op, and that's correlated with increased progression-free survival. NCCN has guidelines outlining exactly what I just said, as well as contouring guidelines and sort of target delineation. Again, you know, the there's not much question about grade one and grade three. It's really grade two that's a bit controversial. SRS, just a quick note, I mean, this is an established alternative therapy to surgery. The data is very clear that for small size tumors, you get a pretty comparable result to a Simpson grade one resection with, you know, 95-96% 10-year control rates with doses above 13 gray. Interestingly, you know, retrospective studies have shown that you're actually more likely to improve cranial nerve problems than worsen them with radiation by a factor about 2 to 1. But the incidence of cranial nerve problems is not immediate like surgery. It's actually borne out over long term. One thing that's been recently advocated for to try to mitigate against that is fractionated stereotactic radiosurgery. It's evolved in the last, you know, couple of years or decade or so to break up the fractionation to be a little gentler on the normal surrounding tissues. Studies of this have not shown any differences in any decreased local control. They haven't haven't demonstrated yet a statistically improved toxicity, but again, this is a relatively newer technology. Again, I mentioned grade 2 tumors. The problem here may be that the studies that have been conducted are not necessarily haven't studied the same types of tumors. The recommendations again for atypical meningioma following gross total resection are sort of up in the air due to conflicting evidence. The best thing that we've sort of got on hand so far are some meta-analyses, and we've got basically one big one of a bunch of studies that did show a statistically significant improvement in five-year survival, but that's sort of offset by another one which didn't. There's some other studies that are a little bit relevant here, but unfortunately none have been specifically targeted or designed to answer the question of what do you do in the setting of a completely resected grade 2. Others have sort of lumped those in with recurrent grade 1s. They have showed pretty good control rates, at least comparative to historical controls. But thankfully, we've got an ongoing multicenter phase 3 randomized control trial happening now that will answer this question. It's basically randomizing post gross total resection grade 2s to 60 gray of radiation or not. And those results are eagerly awaited to answer this question. Systemic treatments remain experimental because the results have just not been great. They're reserved in the guidelines for recurrent progressive disease at people who've exhausted radiation and surgery possibilities. The NCCN does recommend, think about clinical trials for all cases that sort of meet that definition. The problem in assessing systemic treatments, to date has been some difficulty with, standards and definitions. More recently, there's been sort of somewhat of a consensus agreement on, definition of progression as, 15% increase within 6 months, and that the relevant endpoints ought to be 6 month progression-free survival, although some would advocate for an imaging response to 70% 6 month PFS is sort of the benchmark for what the field thinks would be an acceptable, useful therapy. A whole bunch of things have been tried and failed. In grade 1, I've got them listed here. The sort of big one to know is there was a phase 3 randomized control trial with mifepristone, which of course has been in the news a lot lately, but that was unsuccessful in meningiomas. Grade 2s and 3s, same kinds of agents as well as high dose kind of sarcoma protocol chemotherapies like cyclophosphamide, adriamycin, the likes of those, which also were ineffective. While there aren't RCTs to support it, there are, in the field these days, some enthusiasm for agents which target angiogenic pathways like bevacizumab, sunitinib, and mTOR or somatostatin-related pathways like everolimus, octreotide. NCCN comes out with some very weak recommendations for those agents, and so those are an option now, according to the NCCN guideline. And then really, these agents have sort of changed over the years, and that's kind of what's available currently. The whole problem that we run into and all this is inconsistent definitions of meningioma grades, especially over the decades in that are required to study and understand meningioma behavior. Right here, I have listed the WHO 2016 criteria. These have actually recently changed again, and some of these categories have moved around, like papillary rhabdoid histology now doesn't automatically make it a grade 3. There's other molecular features that take that place, and there are some other markers which move in. But basically, the strongest delineator of separating the grades is that the mitotic rate, you know, per 10 high-powered fields, less than 4 is grade 1, 4 to 19, grade 2, and greater than 20 is grade 3. That helps stratify survival actually pretty well. It does a fairly good job of this. The issue that we run into is there's a considerable number of patients, especially grade ones, whose tumors unexpectedly relapse early. And conversely, we have patients with grade 2 meningiomas, especially undergoing complete resection, that have a long indolent course, even without radiation. So how can we improve on that? You know, like I said, this histopathology was a basis of a lot of classification schemes, but as we've moved on in time and changed those, the proportion of grades has changed as well. You know, the update between 2000 and 2007 bumped grade 2s from 5 to 20%. 2016, now we get about a third tumors as grade 2s. And some of the other updates recently might even push that higher with some molecular definitions, especially for clear cell meningioma. Molecular pathology, you know, this is, if you understand one concept about the molecular pathology of meningiomas, it's got to be NF2. This, you know, is the gene that's mutated in the germline syndrome, which causes neurofibromatosis type 2, but it's the most frequently somatically altered event in meningiomas. Commonly, we see a loss of one copy of the gene, as well as a mutation in the other. And that's kind of the two-hit hypothesis and, you know, really the central driver of meningiomas in a large proportion of lesions. Interestingly, tumors that are driven by NF2 are much more likely to encompass grade 2 and grade 3 and have a higher malignant potential, higher potential to progress. And then I think as a surgeon, one of the most interesting facts is that these are actually associated pretty strongly with convexity meningiomas rather than those of the skull base, and particularly those actually located behind the coronal suture. Because NF2 is not the only driver of meningiomas, you know, there's been some large-scale efforts to sequence meningiomas. Other drivers have been identified. This is a study here, sequencing 300 meningiomas published in 2013 that identified a whole host of other drivers that very uniquely correlate anatomically with the location of the tumor. You know, I mentioned that NF2 are along the convexities, posterior skull base, smoothened or sonic hedgehog pathway genes occur in the midline anterior skull base. These are your sort of olfactory groove meningiomas. A combination of mutations for KLF4, TRAF7 define these secretory meningiomas that are often, you know, sphenoid wing locations. And another gene that was even more recently identified, POLR2A, are basically only seen in tuberculum cella lesions. So, you know, knowing this and knowing that these mutations are mostly mutually exclusive does help us correlate, you know, what the drivers are for meningiomas, you know, probabilistically speaking, just by knowing their anatomic location. These molecular drivers also correlate with their grade and expected behavior. They also, of course, would give us a target if we have a therapy that hits that particular target. And shown here is basically a list of different inhibitors which hit the different sort of pathways that we just mentioned. When I was a fellow at MD Anderson, I did a study looking at the molecular profiles of a few hundred meningiomas, which were submitted for next generation sequencing with a company called Caris, which does a sort of multi-platform analysis. It's kind of like Foundation Medicine. I think we're probably familiar with that here. And it validated that these targets are present in the vast majority of tumors which are submitted for this kind of analysis, which of course are going to be ones where people might be looking for a molecular therapy. As I mentioned, you know, the WHO 2021 classification is changing a lot of things. It's now incorporating sequencing as a recommended study It takes into account these driver mutations for the different categories. And actually, in the case of SMARCA1 for clear cell grade 2 meningiomas, that's sort of a pathognomonic mutation. There's another one, BAP1, which is present primarily in rhabdoid subtypes, which, you know, most likely are going to fall in grade 3 categories. Additionally, two other recent molecular alterations have been given a designation that if they're present in a meningioma, that tumor is grade 3, regardless of its histology. And that's a pretty new concept for meningiomas. And those are the TERT promoter mutation, which we're familiar with. Actually, both of these we're familiar with from gliomas. The other is CDKN2A. And, interesting fact is, or what we derive from this is that some of these mutations are actually seen as tumors progress. They can, like, for example, the TERT promoter mutation seems to be one that lower grade tumors can acquire as they become grade 3. We use all this information, we put it together to kind of develop this sort of framework to keep in mind of, you know, the sort of frequency of mutations along with the anatomic location of the tumor. And it sets up this little bit of a dichotomy where, you know, the tumors that have a higher malignant potential might be more amenable to a resection. The ones that, you know, are more difficult located in the skull base, you know, thankfully have lower malignant potential, but obviously we've got a different problem with potential for a residual tumor. This concepts also help us understand the molecular, you know, pathogenesis of these tumors, and it really helps them fall into, you know, two or three large categories, depending on the driver mutations. You know, the ones associated with skull base tumors are, you know, again, they're separate and mutually exclusive to those driven by NF2 or SMARC E1, B1. Those tend to fall in the ones that are, I would classify as, you know, susceptible to malignant transformation or secondary, you know, upgrading to a grade 3, especially with the acquisition of the TERT mutation or additional chromosomal instabilities. Taking it a step further beyond just mutational analysis, multi-omic profiling has helped us understand what's happening, you know, throughout the genome and transcriptome and epigenome of these meningiomas, and can be used to even better stratify the expected behavior and outcome of a given tumor. Shown here in this diagram are the different categories and methylation classifiers, these MCs at the top, that were derived from a study in 2017. The first study that was published was based on about 500 meningiomas. They subsequently updated it to about 3,000. They looked at methylation profiling across the tumor. Basically, you know, the sum total of all the genetic events in a tumor will impact the methylation of the tumor's DNA. This can be measured by sort of hybrid array and generate sort of a fingerprint of what the methylation status is within a tumor. Clustering those together and looking at similarities and differences, all the meningiomas will cluster together away from all other skull-based tumors. And then of the different subtypes of meningiomas, you know, we developed this concept of, you know, these benign, intermediate, and sort of malignant phenotypes. These, you know, do fall in line with the different mutational drivers that were mentioned before, with, you know, NF2 being pretty separate from those kind of skull base related genes, and then, you know, the presence of the TERP promoter and CDKN mutations among the higher grade types. They do fall, you know, in line somewhat with histology, somewhat with gender, and of course, you know, again, are correlated with survival. In the updated version, I think this has really given me hope that this will be something that we can translate into to meaningful, you know, clinical application in the future. What's shown here are basically the sum total of combining things like the methylation profile with histology, with other chromosomal alterations to develop a score, and looking across the sort of the different grades and how they end up falling when you take all these into account, you can see that there are some tumors that would be initially classified as grade one, which going through the sort of molecular analysis pipeline ultimately will cluster and behave more like the intermediate grade ones. Same thing with ones that were expected to be grade two. Some of those actually end up clustering more with malignant ones. This leads us to, you know, expected outcomes, survival curves, which stratify better. And I think, you know, most helpful to us is shown in this figure here, where we're basically have taken the ones that, you know, originally were grade two, show up as, you know, grade one on the molecular, and we see that they end up stratifying with the other grade ones better. The ones that were called grade one, but molecularly are grade two, parallel the grade two much more closely. And so this will hopefully be the sort of answer that we're looking for of what really is a grade one, what really is a grade two, how can we use these treatments, what do they actually do, how do we, you know, get to a place where we don't get studies that say the opposite thing, you know, where we're lumping a bunch of things together, you know, actually separate them out, understand what's happening, and get answers to what we're doing. Here at UCLA, we're adopting some of these changes to 2021. Most notably, we haven't developed methylation profiling yet here on the clinical level. It's actually a difficult thing to do on a CLIA sort of manner. And right now we do have an option of sending tumors to NIH, mainly for classification of, or diagnostic classification. Is it a meningioma? Is it some other kind of tumor? But we have adopted an IHC-based classification, which includes a lot of the markers that I just discussed, BAP1, CDKN, H3K27 was one I didn't really go into, but it does portend a more aggressive type of tumor. TERT promoter is available. And then one of the things that should be rolling out in the near future is a next-generation sequencing panel with about 1,000 cancer genes. That would be an in-house test with hopefully short turnaround and would include all the genes that I just mentioned. So, you know, with those things in mind and these advances in treatment, you know, we do have in our group here some ideas of how to advance treatments for these tumors. We have a couple of hypotheses, which are I'll go into quickly before I wrap up. You know, some of these are that treatments, if we're going to develop a systemic therapy that gets administered to a patient, you know, we shouldn't bother with targets that are only relevant for grade one tumors, which are basically curable with surgery and radiation. We've looked at targeting an antigen that is expression is correlated with high grade meningiomas called NY-ESO-1. We have a way to target it with engineered immunotherapy, and this shows activity in vitro against cells which express the marker. That was some work that was done by our former resident, Matt's son. Josh is working on targeting methylation itself. You know, this is an important determination, you know, determiner of meningioma behavior. If this is what helps classify or stratify these, well, if we could change that, if we could, you know, change the methylation program in a cell, we could potentially change its behavior. So Josh is looking at a target called EZH2, which, you know, again, correlates with increased expression as seen in higher grade tumors. And we see increased activity against those tumors that express this in, you know, in vitro studies with, you know, the pharmacologic inhibitor of EZH2 that's actually FDA approved. Maya is helping sort out how we can correlate these genomic alterations with sensitivity to radiation using some a novel technique called BH3 profiling, which you know, assesses cells for their sensitivity to apoptosis. And you know, we see a suggested relationship between grade, the presence of NF2 alterations, and sensitivity to apoptosis. This would not only theoretically correlate to radiation, but also for the use of agents which could sensitize things to radiation as a different type of measurement than is traditionally done. So even the aforementioned EZH2 inhibitor, other epigenetic agents, as well as several others, you know, in combination with radiation, will hopefully be measurable with this type of assay, help us understand, you know, what the relevant targets are and their interface with standard of care treatments like radiation. Just a quick plug before we finish up, all this research is driven by tissue, which we bank. And unfortunately, we as an institution have not done as great of a job with meningiomas as we have with glioblastoma. And, you know, as evidence here with an increasing number of meningioma surgeries, we have not seen a corresponding increase in tumor banking of meningiomas. We saw this little blip and then a little drop off. I would note that the initial blip of increased banking corresponded with when I started working here. And Maya wants everyone to know that we should feel shame when we don't bank a meningioma, because we got a lot of research to do to figure these out. And with that, I will say thank you, and I'll take any questions.
Oh, I have a question actually about your last point about the banking. What's precluding that? Are people just not calling?
Yeah, I think it's surgeon dependent.
Oh, okay. Well, whoever the surgeon is, yeah, shame.
Testing the patients beforehand and activating our tumor bank. You know, I mean, the other difference is, you know, surgical technique certainly lends itself, I think, better to, you know, meningioma and metastatic brain tumor collection, you know, or metastatic or gliomas. You know, meningiomas come out piecemeal. There's not like often a big chunk to send. So that might be a reason, but it's not a good one.
You can send what's in the CUSA, by the way.
That stuff is very assayable.
And even better is the Myriad, the Nico Myriad.
Curable, though, according to
Japan. Yeah, you probably can't culture, but you can get nucleic acids.
Yeah, so just, yeah, when you're in a case, just, you know, ask the circulating nurse to call the tumor collection person, and they'll collect it. They're on call 24/7, so just please don't forget.
The current policy for the follow-up of the patients who had surgery, radiation, because one of the pathologists, former pathologist, neuropathologist, said they have to be followed indefinitely because it may pop up. What is the current?
Yeah, the NCCN has recommendations stratified by grade. For a grade one tumor that underwent surgery, there's, you know, sort of a prescribed course of, you know, 3, 6, 12 months, 2 years, and then out to about 5 years. And at that point, it is really up to the, you know, discretion of the clinician, whether or not they want to continue following. But it's true that just because you stop following doesn't mean it's not going to come back. There's certainly late recurrences.
So it's to go definitively. I have one friend who had it, surgery, radiation. Every year she goes for MRI, eye doctor checkup. And she said, how long should I go?
Yeah. I mean, certainly the probability diminishes over time. And, you know, it's probably not a cost-effective thing to, you know, indefinitely scan people on a yearly basis. I like sort of a telescoping, you know, increasing length of follow-up. And, you know, after a decade of stability, you know, I think it's up to the discretion of, you know, decision between the clinician and the patient.
You know, to one of the things as residents, you see a very biased group of patients who are going to surgery and not the other 9 patients who we follow in clinic. So most of skull base practice is following patients. And just as a little nuance, you should order high resolution MRI studies like brain lab studies to follow these, because a standard brain MRI, if you don't know, they're 5 millimeter thick slices and often skip 1 to 1.5 millimeters between slices. you cannot follow small tumors, or it's even hard to measure growth.
Yeah, you can't calculate volumetrics either.
So that's just something that I see on the outside. People order whole brain MRI scan, and it's not very good. It's too insensitive. But I think some of that older, you know, in retrospect, you go back, the scan was negative. Well, it actually wasn't negative, but they just weren't doing high resolution studies. So if you have no recurrence in 10 years, the chances of that tumor coming back, you may get a new tumor, but it is so long.
More general question. Are the molecular pathways that you described for localization of these tumors to different areas of the skull base of the brain, for all the chemotherapy agents that people have tried for grade ones, grade twos, do none of those impact any of those pathways? And if they do, have people looked at hey, this impacts Merlin pathway, these Merlin ones?
So that's a great question. The one that probably is most relevant to that is mTOR inhibitors, everolimus. mTOR is something that gets upregulated with NF2. Beyond that, the other ones, the skull-based ones, have not been subject to trials in the past, but there are ongoing sort of basket-type trials that take into account, the sequencing alteration, and they have, a different agent that hits different targets. For sonic hedgehog pathways, there's a drug bismonijib, which is active in other types of tumors that have the same mutations. Same thing for AKT. There's another one there. So yeah, that trial is ongoing, and they just added another arm for the CDKN2A alteration that was more recently discovered. So the more targets we find, the more agents that they can match with, this concept could hopefully come to fruition. There's only a few cases that have been reported of actually, successfully targeting those pathways. I think one of the reasons is, these alterations occur in tumors that by and large are managed effectively with surgery and radiation. So I don't think there's a ton of people out there who, need that pathway. So that's, our strategy anyways has been to focus on NF2 mutated tumors, because those are, the predominant of malignant ones that are going to need a therapy.
Hey, Rich, some of these meningioma surgeries are very long. If you take out part of the tumor and have specimen, should we call tumor collection person early or wait 10 hours later?
Anytime.
When the tumor's been sitting in that bucket out in the, does it make a difference?
Yes, it does.
Actually, if it's going to wait, it should wait on ice. That will preserve things a little better, but they're available. You can call them as many times as you want. They will come, pick up specimen A, specimen B.
Tumors that end up getting SRS, and then you do send molecular profiling on them again a second time, and do you find that after an SRS, some molecular profiles actually do change, or do they all seem to consistently stay within the same profile?
So for the most part, they stay within the same profile. The exception is that TERT promoter. That's the one that has been identified as something that causes a sort of upgrade or, the progression after treatment, after radiation.
The women who have meningioma, because some of them have progesterone or estrogen receptors, in the breast cancer, they put them after removal of the lump, they put them on the medication for 5 years. How come they don't use it in meningioma?
They actually have tried antiprogesterones and estrogens. They have not been successful in meningioma. The another interesting fact is the dichotomy between genders is actually really only seen in grade one. Grade two and grade three is much more equal.
There's anecdotal cases where I think you mentioned the women in Europe, but there's other ailments where high progesterone treatment is used, and they've shown rapid enlargement of meningiomas, and they stopped it, and then the meningioma actually stopped growing or regressed.
So yeah.
In isolated cases, there is something.
And
there.
That theory comes from
observations in pregnancy, right? Meningiomas can expand, and then they spontaneously regress after delivery with, you know, correlating with hormone.
I actually don't think it's coming into menopause that your tumor actually may stop growing. That's maybe a reason not to do something now. Let's wait till and see if it stops growing after menopause. If it's not symptomatic or whatever, if you're on the fence.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's reasonable.
Have you seen that? Go down. I'm not studying it, but you know, it gives them hope. That's one good thing about menopause.
Have you done on the women who had oophorectomy or any cough? Do you have any change with the meningioma progress? Is something to look?
You know, I'm not aware
if any results of a study like that. The one thing that I would correlate to that is, you know, there is an increased incidence in people who have like BRCA mutations, which, you know, they have an increased incidence of breast cancer. There's an increased incidence of meningiomas in patients who have breast cancer too. So all these things are sort of tied together. So that might be a difficult thing to really assess, because people who are getting oophorectomy might have a predisposition to forming tumors anyways.
Replacement therapy.
Yeah.
We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as diagnosis or treatment of a health problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. Please fill out your evaluation of this video to obtain CME credit. This recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. If you have any questions or comments, send them to ausman@snidigital.org. This program is supported by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation, owner of SNI and SNI Digital, and the Waymaster Corporation, producers of the Leading Gen television series, Silent Majority Speaks, Role Models, and the Medical News Network. Thank you.